This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 235 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
You spend a third of your life in your sheets. They make a difference in how you sleep. And you can start getting better sleep with better sheets.
Brooklinen.com has the highest quality sheets, and there's no big markup. So upgrade your nightly routine and feel more well-rested every day.
It's a double-edged sword. I have a really hard time getting out of bed in the morning now. They were founded in April 2014 by a husband and wife team, Vicky and Rich Fullup. Their philosophy, a beautiful home essentials, no crazy prices, which I can totally appreciate because I definitely have caviar taste and potato chip salary.
So this is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today.
I love my Brooklinen sheets. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer for just our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at Brooklinen.com.
Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. And as Summer said, the only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. And now on to our read-along. This week, we're beginning part four, entitled River Run, chapter 10, Jocasta.
It is June 1767, just after the pirate incident. Well, that is the third, fourth, or fifth pirate incident, Summer. I really honestly can't keep
track
anymore.
It's the first in this book.
That's true. Well, I guess it's the first negative pirate incident, because if Stephen Bonnet is a pirate, right?
No, here's the thing. He introduced himself as a smuggler. Generally, smugglers and pirates are not always interchangeable, but it depends on who is describing them as to whether or not they are a pirate or a smuggler. If they are stealing from you, they are a pirate. If they are stealing from someone, that's you. But if they're stealing from somebody else and selling it to you at a discounted rate, they are a smuggler.
That's true. So basically, after that incident, our favorite people in the book, or whatever, arrive. They are finally off that ding-dong boat.
Good Lord.
Raft, whatever. As they arrive at Cross Creek, they smell the scent of turpentine. It's very strong. And they learn that it's to be sent on to Wilmington and Charleston to be sold. And they also smell rum, brandywine, and port.
And that's just what they smell in this part of the chapter. They get to smell way more fun stuff later in the chapter. This is actually the chapter of the most smells, I would say.
It is very smelly. Okay, so Erica B. writes, medicinal elixir. Turpentine and petroleum distillates such as coal oil and kerosene have been used medicinally since ancient times as topical and sometimes internal home remedies. Topically, it has been used for abrasions and wounds, as a treatment for lice, and when mixed with animal fat, it has been used as a chest rub or inhaler for nasal and throat ailments. Many modern chest rubs, such as Vicks Variety, still contain turpentine in their formulations. Turpentine was a common medicine among seamen during the Age of Discovery. It is one of several products carried aboard Ferdinand Magellan's fleet in his first circumnavigation of the globe. Taken internally, it has been used as a treatment for intestinal parasites and candida because of its antiseptic properties. And we will share that link that Erica shared with us in the show notes. Cindy R. writes, again, channeling summer, again, our olfactory senses are assaulted with the descriptions of turpentine and rum. Imagine that in the humid air of the South. One doesn't need to have Jamie's, quote, nose like a mongoose, unquote, to appreciate how overwhelming that would be. So they clean themselves up. Oh my goodness, this is going to be a rough night. They have cleaned themselves up as much as possible. Jamie is really worried about showing up a beggar and looking the part. The only part that was a bit off, not fine looking, were his shoes, Claire tells us. Young Ian, unfortunately, was one of those people you couldn't take anywhere. He always managed to do something to new or nice things. They do their best by him and tell him to keep his mouth shut as much as possible. I mean, I guess you have to. Erica B. writes, it's rather endearing how concerned Jamie is to make sure he and the family look presentable when they meet Aunt Jocasta. Funny how habits like that haven't changed in over 200 years. So Jamie promises to tell Jocasta about the pirates, but let's give her a minute, Diana's description of River Run is gorgeous. Note that she describes a certain white marble mausoleum that we may or may not get to visit at some point in the future.
Like,
I said may or may not in the future.
Is that's not even in this book, is it? That's like,
we're not going to talk about that. I said may or may not.
I'm just saying, teasing something out like that we are probably a good 2 or 3 years from.
I didn't tease. I mean, I guess I teased.
Exactly.
Oh, Lord. No, it's not that. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it may not come in this book or come back in this book, but it's in more than one book. So it's not waiting for 3 years. It might be waiting for one or two, but it comes back in multiple books. Claire recognizes Jocasta at once. She's tall and has very Mackenzie-esque facial features and white hair. She comes down to them on the arm of her butler. Jamie steps forward, embraced her, and said, quote, Aunt, it's Jamie, unquote. Claire realizes that Jamie must be seeing a hint of his mother in Jocasta. She appears to have blue eyes. Jocasta is very happy he's there. Jamie presents Claire. Now it's her turn to have a pang. Quote, feeling a small pang of recognition at the long, strong fingers. Though her knuckles were slightly knobbed with age, her skin was soft and the feel of her grip was unnervingly like Brianna's, unquote. Cindy R. writes, my first impression of Jocasta based on a description is she's a bit cool, with an air of disdain. Then, through interactions, I warm to her. She seems genuinely happy to receive Jamie and Claire. She's definitely used to having things her way and has mastered the art of manipulation to get people to do her bidding. I wonder if this was something that's been inherent in her or if it developed as she lost her sight. Well, that's a good point. But remember, she is a Mackenzie, and that point is made later on in this chapter. Anne S. writes, at River Run, they're impressed by the plantation home and formal gardens. Arriving at River Run and meeting Jocasta is an interesting mix of the familiar and the new. Here's a woman whom Jamie has barely met, barely remembers too, but whose appearance is strikingly Mackenzie, reminding Jamie of his mother and reminding Claire of Brianna. They're welcomed into the genteel southern home, enjoy imported Scotch whiskey, and are served by slaves speaking with Scottish accents or in Gaelic. This adaptation of the Scottish Highlands in the southern colonies must have been at once comforting and surprising for Jamie and Claire. And then it's young Ian and Fergus's turn. They go inside and Jocasta is on the arm of her butler. And by turn, I mean like to be introduced. Once they're inside, Jocasta offers them a dram. Apparently, Uncle Hector had put away a bit of whiskey. There's lots of description of Jocasta pointing or putting her hand out and the butler, Ulysses, just appearing, putting things right where she can reach them, like a synchronized dance, like a bit of choreography. Cindy R. writes, whiskey is not my drink. I have it on occasion, usually in hot tea and honey when I have a sore throat. However, Diana's description of it as, quote, smooth as buttered silk and heartening as sunshine, unquote, makes me want to down a shot ASAP. I know Scotland's tourism has grown with Outlander's popularity. I wonder if anyone has investigated its impact on the sale of whiskey. That's a good point. We don't really hear, I mean, whiskey, I don't think has ever been in danger.
I have never tried to convince anyone that whiskey was my drink.
But that's a good point. I don't know that I've read anything that separated that out, you know?
No, but if I had 30 years of it stockpiled because of I purchased too much and now I can't sell it, I would definitely make it my drink because I have 30 years worth of it.
Or that it tasted like buttered sunshine.
Exactly. Also, I am super excited that Scotland is in the gin game now. I'm excited. I want to go try Scottish gins. I think I could get behind that. I could get behind that 100%. I like a gin and tonic.
Seriously. We may have an opportunity. I don't know our schedule during Pod Abroad in May, but we may have an opportunity, time, I mean, to do a little bit, maybe, when we're there. We'll have to see. But that will be, I'd be very willing to do that kind of tasting because I've never done a gin tasting. Jocasta says she'll have Ulysses write to Jenny in Scotland, letting her know they're safely arrived. Jimmy tells her about the pirates. She basically says, don't worry. I do mean you to be welcome here. It's your home. We'll surely find a way to restore your fortune.
She already has a plan.
Yeah. Young Ian points out a painting of a view of the mountains and asks Jocasta if she'd painted it. And she had. She tells of how she and Hector would go into the mountains. Servants would light a fire that would last for days, or they would keep it going for days. And natives, of course, Indians. And Summer and I said this before. I don't know. We definitely said it at the beginning of DOA. If we slip and say Indians, because that's in the text, of course, you know, we mean Native Americans because, of course, at this time and then in the 18th century, they were called Indians. It may just as I take notes, as Summer listens and we store things away that we want to discuss. I mean, I don't know a happy medium, Summer. I know we can say Native Americans. I think what we agreed on, Native Americans is the general term. But once we get into the different tribal names, that's a lot easier. Right now, we don't have that yet. So it's like, I feel like I'm stumbling over myself every time.
Well, just be sure to quote it. Make it a quote from the book as opposed to
if it's someone's words or an important description, I will. This is not an important description. It's just saying what happened. And natives who are Indians, or as they are now known, Native Americans, would come down, or I'm guessing from the mountains, would come and find them by the fire. There was like a signal fire. And they'd sit around the fire and talk and drink whiskey and trade. And all this time, Jocasta would draw. And then she brings young Ian's attention to another painting with an Indian in it, Native American in it. And then Rollo interrupts. He's kind of getting a little frisky, like he sees something outside, and it's a skunk. And this scene, I'm not going to describe it, but it is hilarious. Like both Jamie and Ian are like, oh, a skunk?
Well, because, you know, they heard about the big bad skunks and how they're ferocious and
And Claire tried to say, look, it's not a big bad thing. And they're just like, they're going with what they heard. They're only going with what they heard. Heaven forbid Claire lived there for 20 years.
But I know. But then conversely, she may have downplayed them a little too much because they were like, oh, well, it's nothing. You know, they're not big and ferocious. Clearly, you have no idea what a real skunk is and you've been hearing wrong. And then they show out and they're like, oh, they just look like a polecat or whatever they called the thing that they were comparing it to. And then they lost all feeling of
fear,
trepidation, or anything else that, you know, the natural reaction that anyone who's actually encountered a skunk before has is just gone. And so they run out to go mess with it. And even the dog did, which I would have thought the dog was a little smarter than that.
Well, now he is.
I give Rollo too much credit, clearly.
So, of course, they find out that it stinks. And it's all Ian's fault. He freaking used some kind of stick or metal, like he poked it. Really? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Poked it? Dude, you couldn't pay me. You couldn't pay me to poke it with a stick. You couldn't pay me to get within like 10 feet of a skunk. If I'm walking somewhere, like I've had times where I've seen, so stupid, but we used to, I swear we had a skunk path in our backyard at one point, and you could smell them, like a path through the backyard that they would traverse to get from one place to another. You could like smell it coming from one end of the house to the other, and then it would get really strong. And then I would like hide, like it was going to make anything happen. Like, please don't spray the area. But but if I see one, I'm probably more scared of that than I am an actual predator. I won't go outside at all. I might go outside to shoo something larger and with bigger teeth away, but I'm not going outside anywhere near a skunk.
And after he bugs it with a stick, Jocasta is like, she's wondering what's going on, and she's looking around like she's lost. And this is finally Claire puts two and three together. She realizes that Jocasta is blind.
Do you think they're going to have that big reveal?
And not just have her be introduced as blind?
Right. Or have her saying something like, my eyesight isn't what it used to be.
Okay. I think they're going to have a reveal. I think she needs to be blind for the storyline, obviously.
Well, yeah.
Too many things in the future are linked to that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she relies so much on Ulysses, and I'm not trying really hard not to spoil here. The fact that she relies so much on Ulysses, as we come to find, I think it pretty much in this chapter, in the next few chapters, is huge, is absolutely huge. And she would never have to rely on him. He would still be a great butler, but she would never have to rely on someone so much if she weren't blind. And that comes in hugely in like two or three books from now. Amazingly huge. So anyway, yeah, I think they're going to have a reveal. It may not be a skunk, although that's easy to fake, right? It could be something happens at a table. I don't know. But to me, it would make sense that it has to probably be something that is out of the ordinary, because that is her home. She knows it like literally the back of her hand. She can't see, but she can hear and smell. And if anything is going on indoors and Ulysses is around, he can either help with something, or she can, at least she knows where people are by their voices. The fact that people got up and left, and like half the people went outside to go play with this thing, that's like taking you and me and blindfolding us, obviously, and spinning us around and then stopping us and having us try and walk across the room, even maybe without a blindfold. So for her control to be blind as she is and to be so successful, it has to be in her very steady environment. And anything with doors open and sounds from outside, and like non-human sounds especially. And these are also new people, right? So a dog is not typical for her. These new people are not typical for her. Fergus is not typical for her with his language or his accent. You know, it's just so many new things that if they were all indoors, I think it would be fine. And it would be something else that outed her. But the fact that everyone is like run away to see what the heck, you know, stay away, everyone's concern has gone elsewhere. That's why she's freaked out, or she looks like she's lost, because she is. She can't rely on the sounds and distance of people's speech anymore. Or people have left the room. She and no one has said, we're going outside to check on X. They're just moving and not telling her anything. And that's why it was kind of dropped like that.
Here's my next question for you. So since Jocasta was born with full sight and had full sight for most of her life, and only recently, or I don't know how recently, but for the last however many years has been gradually losing her eyesight, has she gradually been gaining superpowers in her other senses?
Or did it just happen once she went totally blind?
Yeah.
That's a good question for any listeners we may have. First of all, if someone is visually impaired or blind, whether it's from birth or whether it's from later on, especially if you acquired it later in life, did you notice your sense of hearing growing more keen and sensitive in direct proportion to the loss of your sight? Or did you notice it and when you really had to rely on it, obviously, once it was completely gone? Or completely lost. So yeah, I think that's a good question. I want to say it's like an inverse. So as one declines, the other increases. First of all, it's a pretty picture, right? One arrow down, one arrow up. It just makes sense. It's like a balance. But that doesn't mean it's reality. But the reason I think that is because the more you begin to rely on something, the more acute it becomes. Now, I'm going to say something that's not scientific, but and I could totally be, I don't want to say proven wrong, because I'm not trying to like state a fact. But my belief is, you know, when people at whichever point her hearing became like crazy good, right? I would posit that I don't know that her hearing is necessarily better now. I think she's more attuned to what she can pick up with it now. You know what I'm saying? I don't think you suddenly increase. I think you can increase your subjectivity and your ability to filter out sounds and concentrate on things. But for example, let's just be like legit here and like hardcore scientific. If you go take a hearing test and you say you have like some loss of hearing, like some low pitches or some high, whatever, you have like a really good hearing. You have really good hearing, like normal hearing. But, you know, for whatever reason, you have a little bit of hearing loss that's really you're not too worried about because you're not going to be like listening to Ginger Catterwall, you know, up in the high rafters, right? Let's say you have that. And then you go blind. What I'm trying to say is I don't think once you go blind or gradually go blind, that you legit regain what you've lost because of damage. I don't know that that's possible. I don't think that happens. Please tell me if I'm wrong. What I believe is I don't think the pitches and tones, like your physical capability of hearing things, right? As far as like your pitch or something, I don't think that improves because, again, you're not going to grow a better ear because your sight is gone. However, you are more attuned to what you do hear. You adapt to it. You filter or you concentrate, you focus, and with that extra attention, what you can gather, the evidence that you can gather from what you physically can capture with your ear is improved because you're attending it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because I just have a hard time believing that, oops, I lost my sight. Suddenly, I can hear things I could never hear before. And by sounds, I don't mean like the scratching in the background, because that's like background noise. That is something that I believe you can filter out or filter in. What I'm talking about is like low pitches and high pitches and physically adding to your physiological capability. I don't believe that's what happens. But I do believe that everything becomes more acute, more attended to, and thus, if you're paying attention, it's like a muscle, right? The more you practice it, the better it's going to be. And if that's like the only muscle you got because you can't see, it's going to become pretty darn good. You know what I mean? Okay. So stop asking me questions because it takes me 10 minutes to answer you. And this is a damn long chapter. We got a lot of recording. Erica B writes, the skunk scene is so funny. I do hope they keep it in the show. Both Jocasta and Claire try to tell the boys about skunks, but they are either too excited or worried about it to stop and listen. They have learned the hard way for sure that these wee beasties are definitely dangerous. And she writes, do you think Claire told her gang about Jocasta being blind that night? I would imagine so. I find it amazing that Jocasta was able to make it seem like she could see for so long without actually saying anything about it. She's a strong woman, very stoic and graceful, and I can imagine her not wanting to disclose this weakness. I think she definitely would have told Jamie, but I don't see what she gains by not telling the others, you know, in private, because she doesn't want to make a big deal of it. First of all, not everything that happens is on screen / on the page, right? So as soon as this scene ends, they all could have talked about it. We don't know. If they all went to bed right away, then yeah. If it didn't happen off page, or if it didn't happen in the presence of Jocasta, then my guess is Claire 100% told Jamie if he didn't already know. But I think she would have also shared that with Fergus and young Ian. Do you think?
Probably.
I mean, just to save them like any embarrassment in case they discovered it like out in front of her and they're like, what? You can't see that? You know what I mean? I think she'd want to spare her any unnecessary embarrassment, even though she may not be embarrassed about it. You don't do that to someone. You know, you share it respectfully and privately so that important information is shared, you know, as necessary, so that you don't create, potentially have a situation where someone can be injured, right? Or, you know, definitely embarrassed, if you can avoid it. Cindy R. writes, I can totally picture Ian's run-in with the skunk. Again, can you imagine that smell being carried on humid air? Oh, I think that would make me vomit. It's bad enough in like our air. Can you imagine, Summer?
No, but skunk makes me, it smells like home to me.
The thick, humid, wet, moist air, thick with skunk?
Well, because I've been places, I've lived many places in my life, and in most of those places, skunks were not indigenous to the area.
Oh, so you think of California?
Yeah, it makes me think not just of California, but it makes me think of where we live in California, because we're near the river.
A lot of rivers.
Lots of skunks. So when I smell skunks, it makes me think, oh, we're home.
You know what I think? I think of skunk. I think of home.
I do.
Oh, Lord, Summer. And she continues, ugh, makes me sick to think about it. Also, can we talk about the ingenious idea of growing tomatoes behind the privy for scent control? It's the 18th century version of air freshener. Even though it doesn't sound like it's terribly effective, I give them a round of applause for the effort. And of course, she's referring to the tomatoes they use, right, to go put to crush on Ian and
the dog, right?
Oh, yeah, Ian and Roll. Because Fergus didn't go out there, did he? I mean, he may have. I don't think he got sprayed. How could I know? I just read it, but whatever. Whoever got sprayed got tomatoed. So over dinner, Jocasta suggests that the newcomers go to the turpentine works in the forest above River Run to get a look at the way things go and how everything works, and to be outdoors and less stink. It would take a day to get there and back. So more time with the stinkers out of River Run. Fergus wants to go into town, however. He wants to send word, wants to send a letter to Marsali in Jamaica, and he wants to do it himself. Or at least deliver the letter, not deliver the letter, send the letter himself. Jocasta went with them on the ride to the turpentine works. Her servant, Phêtre, tied a strip of linen over her eyes. We find out that she sees nothing, like no colors, no shapes, no anything. She literally only sees pure light, and that it gives her a headache. And Claire, of course, the more information she finds out from her, starts thinking medically about what type of disease or condition Jocasta may have. And they all got horses to ride and no carriage. And that makes sense. And it's actually probably better. I mean, who knows about the footpath or the travel path, the road. Even if there was a decent road, do you want to be in a carriage with people who just got squirted with skunk juice? I think not.
Skunk juice.
This is the way to go. As they ride, Jocasta describes a mill and how the sawing and shaping of the wood is done there. And then the boards and barrels are sent via barge to Wilmington. Now, the largest part of the mill's output was masts and spars for the Royal Navy. Now, River Run did lots of business with the Navy. Cindy R. writes, regarding the description of the mill and how sap was made into pitch, turpentine, or tar. What a dangerous business. I always appreciate Diana's research when it comes to sections like this. I think in our modern world, we seldom think back to how rudimentary processes such as this were before the ease of machinery. Also, if there were injuries, burns, etc., trying to treat them was next to impossible. It helps me appreciate the world I live in today. So as they near the mill, they come across a slave who was leading a mule to collect the turpentine that is collected in a tree. The mule goes bonkerdonk at the sight of Jocasta and her companions. She says, quote, that will be Clarence. He likes to see folk.
Clarence!
Yes. And the slave that had been leading Clarence had his lower jaw had basically been blown off in a pitch explosion.
You know, I have a really hard time reconciling turpentine as I know of it today with what I imagine is an awful lot like tapping maple syrup trees, only way more explosive, apparently.
That's funny. Yeah, I imagine it being similar.
You never hear of anyone dying tapping a tree for maple syrup. That you think it would be way more expensive to buy maple syrup if people were dying over it.
Well, definitely not as delicious.
I don't know. I've never eaten turpentine.
You go for it, girl.
I'm good.
Erica B. writes, Clarence! I had forgotten how we met him. Not a terrible spoiler, but this won't be the last time we see him. I hope they cast a great actor mule for this role. Just as important as Rollo, if you ask me. Cindy R. writes, we meet Clarence the Mule braying hello. For those who've read the series, isn't it fantastic to mark this first meeting of this important character? That's why I enjoy going back to reread. I pick up on little details that at first seem insignificant, but become so important down the line. I'm not going to lie. She does say Clarence likes to see people. Okay, she did add to it. But when we first get the first bit about a mule named Clarence and he like made like a lot of mm-hmm. noise, again, on like read number like 83, I don't know. It is like you forget, right? You forget this is how we meet him. And like that dude gets around, Clarence does. You guys will see in many books from now. Ah, it's not really a spoiler. Who cares about a mule, right? Oh my gosh. When I saw it, I was like, oh, I agree with him. I was like, Clarence. happens, and it's so like, it's annoying, but it's hysterical, and it's lovely. It's lovely. When you read about Clarence, were you kind of surprised that it was here? Did you remember?
Well, I guess I was. It made me more surprised as to the perceived longevity of
of mules,
of mules in general. Oh, that's funny. And it made me question the average lifespan of a mule.
Okay, do we need to Google that?
I can.
Okay, you have 30 seconds.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Why? Don't stress me out. Not over Clarence.
Google.
I'm doing it. How long do mules live?
Like 30 years?
Mules live longer than horses, as high as 50 years.
Mother, father.
Compared to the horses' 30-ish years. They also have a greater number of years where they can be productive, averaging about 18 years to a horse's 15 years of productivity on a farm-like setting.
What about, and I'm adding to the 30 seconds, by the way. I'm giving you more time because I have a question. How long do donkeys live?
How long do donkeys?
They're probably like more like horses. No, because they're, yeah, I don't know.
Donkeys live 25 to 30 years.
Oh, they're like the shortest lived. That's so sad. Okay. So they arrive at the mill. It is loaded with people all doing their jobs. There are three men in British naval uniforms and another in a bottle green coat. The latter was Mr. Farquhar Campbell. Jocasta introduces him to Jamie. Claire notes that Campbell seems to be almost relieved to meet Jamie. Hmm. Lieutenant Wolfe. And the men in naval uniforms were Lieutenant Wolf and two ensigns, and they introduced themselves. Jamie communicated to Claire that she, quote, take his aunt and bugger off while business was conducted, mm-hmm. unquote. But Jocasta didn't want to leave. She encourages Claire to go with Josh. There were sheds in the clearing. This is like she's describing kind of the layout of the sawmill and the buildings that are like kind of further out. And it seemed to be that one of these sheds appeared to be sleeping quarters, and two or three larger fires were in the clearing. Over these fires hung huge kettles of turpentine. Erica B. writes, I suppose it isn't too common to see a black person speak Scots the way Josh does. How they kept a straight face through that is amazing. Now, I didn't write about that, but what she's talking about is Josh, who was definitely not the one leading Clarence, because I don't think that dude could have like enunciated very well. But once they got to the clearing, I believe Josh was there kind of helping out, and he was like running around and he talked a lot and he spoke Scots, if not Gaelic. And so, yeah, I could absolutely imagine that would be just like so like cognitive dissonance, like this sound should not be coming out of this mouth. It just doesn't make sense. It's nothing they've seen before. So I can't be the only one, Erica continues, that thinks Lieutenant Worf from Star Trek whenever I read Lieutenant Wolf.
I'm just trying to find this Josh person you keep talking about in the book. I'm looking for it right now. Like, I listened to Davina today read this chapter, and I don't recall anyone named Josh. I found it. It is, there is a Josh, but I'm just like, that sounds like such a
contemporary, I know, right?
Name, just have Josh. Like, if she'd been like Joshua, if it had been Joshua, I would have been like, okay. But like, the Josh just like stuck out for me, and every time he said it, it stuck out more. So I had to look that up.
Claire looks back at Jamie chatting with the dudes and sees Jocasta totally eavesdropping. She'd said she would stand in the shade since the heat was too much. Quote, standing pressed against the shed wall out of sight of the men within was Jocasta Cameron. Having abandoned her pretense of exhaustion, she was plainly listening for all she was worth.
Hey, if you have a superpower, you use it.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. No, you're right. If you only have one power, you use it. Josh relays that Jocasta does not like to not know of things or be in charge of them.
Well, think of how helpless she feels.
Oh, she felt helpless back at her house when people ran after a skunk. She didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. So she doesn't want to be taken advantage of. And I think that because of that, and because of probably how strong of a woman she has been for her whole life and how she took care of so many of the things probably on her own, and she's used to being very heavy-handed in the way things are run, I think she's very not afraid. I don't think she's scared, but she doesn't want to be taken advantage of. And she doesn't want anyone to try to pull the wool over her already blind eyes. So
we find out, I think toward the end, we do find out toward the end of this chapter exactly why. Not just like, oh, the men don't want me to listen, so I'm gonna eavesdrop. It's much more than that. There, she has a significant reason why she deserves to know what's going on. And we get that is slowly revealed in the chapter. But I understand, as Summer said, I understand that about Jocasta, right? Not liking to not know things when she's already, I mean, she is helpless in a certain way. She's very, for her lack of eyesight, she gets a ton of crap done. I mean, yes, she has slaves. I get it. But she is very capable for someone who is blind. She is, for all she lacks, she is amazingly perceptive and amazingly capable. However, this is the Navy. Before she can ask why Jocasta would want to manage the Navy, there's an accident. And of course, she means Claire, because Claire is seeing this. A mound that had been covered up with turves blows up. It makes almost no sound. Jamie, Claire, Jocasta, and Ian are all okay. Now, I had to look up turves. I was like, wait, is that a spell check error or something? No, it's the plural of turf. So turf. So normally if I said something about turf, I would say, like, you know, go out, stand on the turf, maybe. Or I would say a piece of turf, right? Like if you're cutting it out of the ground, a piece of turf. Well, this is just turf, turves. So I'm guessing it's pieces of turf are called turves. I can't speak to like how big they are, but plural of turf is turves. So who would have thunk it? This explosion was a pitch explosion. A charcoal fire is set below a pot of pitch. Then they cover this entire pit with earth and turves to keep it in, to keep the heat in, but allow air to circulate and keep the fire going. But it's difficult to manage the flow of the air. And thus if enough air can't exchange, the pressure can build up and there could be an explosion. Jocasta had been forgotten by everyone. It's another skunk, but much more dangerous. So she, like, this, there's a, actually it's not a loud boom. There's not really a loud sound, but there's an explosion. People understandably are running around to figure out, you know, what happened, who's hurt. Let's get everyone accounted for. And among this, or during this freak out, understandably, she's been left behind, because number one, Claire's like, oh my gosh, where's Jamie? So Claire is looking at Jocasta when this happens. And then she goes off. Well, she knows enough that she's been okay, because she just told us that she's okay. But Jocasta was, other than Claire, no one knew what Jocasta was doing. Jocasta was like, you know, holding the wall up outside, trying to get all the lowdown. And so people who were inside probably ran outside. Jamie doesn't know where she is. Campbell and the ensigns and Lieutenant Wolf don't know where she is. So part of it, Jocasta, is your own freaking fault. You don't go. And this is not going to sound, this is very bad feminist. Kind of like Claire. She doesn't do what she's asked. And I don't mean in every single day of anything, like be ruled by a dude or be ruled by society. I just mean when your safety could be maybe something worth something, right? Oh my gosh. But she, for not being related, they got some stuff in common. So yeah, so left alone, blind, unable to make sense of what had happened or where to go for safety. So she's pretty pissed again. So in their discussion, okay, after the fact, Jocasta asks about Burns. Now Burns is the overseer. Wolf, Lieutenant Wolf, says that Burns wasn't there when they arrived, but Campbell arrived soon after. Jamie then mentions, Aunt, didn't we bring like lunch? And why don't we all go eat over there? So when Jamie mentions the victuals, everyone seems happy. And then they go to eat, and then Jamie can go see what's going on. So we find out that the lieutenant visits the Turpentine Works quarterly. So each time Lieutenant Wolf visited, it was for the purpose of drawing up a new contract, right, between River Run, or that mill, and the Navy. It was a contract for the purchase and delivery of assorted naval stores, Diana writes. The lieutenant went around and made these types of arrangements with plantation owners all over the area. And he really is a fan of whiskey. And he thinks the Scots are really good at making it. But otherwise, okay, these are definitely his views, so I'm not sugarcoating them. But you have to, he's pretty far gone drunk. So he's like lost most of his inhibition. He thinks Scots are, quote, a race both lazy and stubborn, a pair of traits which renders them unfit for, and then at this point, he does not get to finish his sentence. Smartly, one of the young ensigns makes a diversion so that Lieutenant is not able to finish his thought. And he turns to Claire and he says, "You're not Scotch, right? You have no trace of the barbarous accent, quote, in spite of your associations." I mean, dude's like really laying it on. What a charmer. What luck the Scotch in the area have that one of this opinion was sent into, quote, possibly the largest collection of Scottish Highlanders to be found in the New World, unquote. So while they're picnicking, Jamie and young Ian are restoring order to the clearing. Now, all this time, Jocasta is sitting next to Campbell, her hand on his arm. Campbell helps move things along. They give him, meaning Wolf, the remaining bottle of whiskey and say, "Since you're leaving so soon, let's finalize the contracts, aye?" And I love it. Quote, "Wolf seems vaguely surprised he was about to leave," unquote. Oh, Diana. He's definitely more than a bit drunk. And they do everything for him. They like, I'm making up the details, but they basically, they have the contract out, they have the quill out, they have someone like a person or a slave bending over, someone like going to be a writing desk. I mean, they're like, "Ready, go." And he's like, okay. And he signs and they get rid of him. So they make it safely back to River Run. Jamie is not happy. Quote, "I wish to know the meaning of yon wee charade. I'm lured to the forest upon the pretext of smelling turpentine, and before I ken where I am, I'm sitting with the British Navy saying aye and nay to matters I ken nothing of. We yon wee manny kicking my shins under the table like a trained monkey," unquote. He's also suspicious of Farquhar Campbell. The latter explains, their arrival, Jamie and Claire et al., their arrival was fortuitous, but there wasn't time to communicate the whys and wherefores. So everyone gets situated and Campbell tells the story. I'm doing lots of quoting or paraphrasing here. The majority of River Run's revenues were derived from the sale of its timber and turpentine products. Their number one customer was the British Navy. The Navy is no longer what it once was. And in the last 10 years, since they were so peaceful, ships had been left to rot. No new ships had been built in the last 5 years, but they still had to keep their existing fleet afloat and thus needed pitch and turpentine and spars. However, the market had shrunk and the Navy could have its choice of whom to do business with. They required dependability, and until Hector's death, Lieutenant Wolfe had been dealt with by him. Now, however, business had been severely affected, not just because there was less cash available for bribes, according to Campbell, but Wolf had come to give his condolences at one point in the past and propose marriage to Jocasta. Jamie's reaction is hysterical, but they clear it up, or she clears it up. "Look, it's not my person, rather my land." Wolf wants her lands from which he could guarantee the naval contracts and get even richer for himself. But Jocasta was not a bad catch herself. Quote, "Blind or not, she was a striking woman. Beyond the simple beauty of flesh and bone, though, she exuded a sensual vitality that caused even such a dry stick as Margaret Campbell to ignite when she was near," unquote. Cindy R. writes, "Lieutenant Wolf, what a pompous drunken oaf. Needing two ensigns to make sure he completes the task of getting contracts signed and back safely says a lot about what the Navy thinks of him as well. His dislike of Scots is palpable, so I'm sure the negotiations with Jamie didn't sit well with him. I feel sorry for Jocasta. She so wants to command the negotiations, but the combination of her disability and being a woman prevent that. Jamie is not happy to have been thrown into this kebby-lebby," gratuitous turn of phrase because I adore it, "without warning. He begins to see more clearly what Jocasta hopes to gain from having him around. Jamie asks about her relationship with Campbell, whom we find out is married with 8 kids. But he knew Hector for more than 30 years and says he would do his best by Jocasta. But how does Jamie come and fit into all of this? Jocasta had put off a lieutenant from marriage under the guise of bereavement and had taken to her bedroom, where she stayed until he'd left town. I mean, he could have been there for days. Who knows? That's hysterical. Burns, the overseer, was also a drunk, like Wolf. Jocasta can certainly take care of the estate with Ulysses' help, but there are things she cannot do. Lieutenant Wolf made that point to her, not able to go to the forest and oversee things. And she knows, and he knows, that she couldn't depend on Burns. Jocasta had planned for Campbell to come help with Wolf on this trip. So she was doing her best to do exactly what was in her power. When Jamie et al. Had arrived, change of plans. Jocasta told Campbell he should tell the lieutenant that her nephew had come to take up management of River Run. Quote, that would cause him to go forward cautiously, Jocasta said, for he would not dare press me with a kinsman who had an interest standing by. Unquote. Okay, I like Jocasta, Summer. I love Jocasta, but just like Jocasta played Wolf, played Jamie and his immediate family, I also recognize that she uses people to her advantage. Completely understandable given her condition and her widowhood, but it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, right? She could have put Jamie in a dangerous position. She technically did, right? He could have gotten blown up. Her hand-holding of Jamie right at this moment kind of makes me sick. She holds Jamie's hand, and this is what she says to him, quote, I could not risk that you would refuse a part in the deception, did I tell you of it first. Do say that you hold no grudge toward me, Jamie, if only for sweet Ellen's sake, unquote.
I mean, it's...
You don't effing bring up the name of his dead mother.
It was done for a purpose. It was manipulative. She was being manipulative, getting her way.
Of course. Okay, and we're going to get there. Now, Jamie isn't upset. He says he's not upset. And all are happy. And it's time to drink. Claire recalls something Jamie had said once. Quote, Frasers are stubborn as rocks. And Mackenzies are charming as larks in the field. But sly as foxes with it. Unquote. So yes, basically, as long as everything is going well. Mm-hmm. The problem is, Jocasta was helping them. I don't think she would have ever not helped out her family. But... And I don't even think she needs to have something done in return. You know, I don't think she's necessarily 100% a tit for tat. However, if she's going to do all this stuff for you, when and if something comes up, then she'll expect a tat. You know what I'm saying? I don't think she goes into helping them with a plan. It just so happened that there was a time right when they got there that they could help. And she like just slipped them in without even like letting them know.
Without even buying him dinner first.
Seriously. And then she tries to hold his hand afterwards. Like that makes up for it. Anne S. writes, This adventure reveals many things about Anne Jocasta and River Run. Despite being blind, she is quite able and heavily involved in the running of the plantation. Now we see why Jocasta repeatedly invited Jamie to consider this as his home. So while Jocasta could truly use Jamie's help to manage her property and business, she shows a manipulative side. Yep. And Fergus. He'd been in town sending that letter to Marsali. He'd spent some time with some French fur traders in town when he was there, and he picked up a letter for Jamie. It was a packet of three letters, one from Jenny, one from Ian, and one marked private, also from Ian. Ian says that Jamie has been restored to Jenny's good graces, and he shares news of home and babies born. Another letter, marked private, was also from Ian. In it, he asks Jamie to please not send young Ian home. that's funny, but he's very serious. They're concerned that there is nothing but poverty and want for him in Scotland and, quote, no hope of betterment, unquote. Ian definitely has a poésie, Jamie says. Young Jamie and Michael are set up for the moment. They'll not likely become soldiers, but young Ian is the one who wants that adventurous life. Ian then goes on to say that he fears for Jamie's soul, and he has since Culloden, and sees the same hardness in his eyes as he did in Simon Fraser's. Ian gives Jamie and young Ian to each other, that one might save the other. What did you think of Ian's letters, Sam?
I was more concerned that Jenny's letter was going to be a howler.
Like a funny one or a yelling one?
No, like Harry Potter. Those were the red ones that screamed at you. And
Erica B. writes, letters from Jenny and Ian. How timely they have arrived. It amazes me that letters find their way so consistently during that time, especially from overseas. The first letter we read is like one you would receive at Christmas time, summing up all that has happened over the year or months in this case. I just love the sweet story of the adults playing Scots and Savages with the bairns. Sounds like a fun time. Ian's second letter leaves us a lot to think about. Firstly, he asks that young Ian stay with Jamie out of fear of what his life might be back in Lallybroch. He's afraid he's going to run off and join the regiment. I cannot blame him on that one. I can't imagine how worrisome that is for a parent, and Ian has a strong adventurous streak in him that is hard to tamper down. He would be too bored on the farm, just as Ian implies. And not only that, Ian also worries for Jamie, hoping that he doesn't end up like Simon Fraser, kind of like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. The Force is strong with Jamie, and he could easily go in the way of his grandsire if he's not careful. That's actually not a bad comparison.
Well, I think that it's very clear that older Ian has not read the rest of this book because it's not very safe in the colonies.
Look, all we got to do is read chapter 10 and skunks. Oh, skunks and pirates. Come on.
So far, the only good thing about the colonies is you got a dog.
I mean, forget this. That's just since they got to Georgia. What about before Georgia? He almost was almost killed.
The journey to the colonies.
Yes, almost killed
him. Almost killed him.
Cindy R. writes, I think the letter from Ian at the end of this chapter helps to soothe Jamie a bit. He can't help but be relieved that he's back in his sister's good graces. Asking Jamie and Claire to keep wee Ian with them gives one an idea of just how desperate life in Scotland is at this time. Imagine preferring your son stay an ocean away. Oh, Lord, I'm working hard, Summer.
Don't do it.
I'm working
so
hard.
Don't do it. I believe in you.
I'm working. I'm holding up the H. Hold on. I'm working. In a fairly unsettled new world. Woo, who is that? Cindy R, girl? Oof, you almost gave it to me. Where was I? Okay. In a fairly unsettled new world, than to return to your home and risk his following the army. It would take a great amount of strength as well as trust to do such a thing. I think this chapter gives us a couple parallel themes between Jamie and Jocasta. First, they both want to project an outward appearance of well-being. Jamie, by being concerned that he not look like a beggar and taking care with his dress, schooling Ian in dress and manners. Jocasta, by structuring her world to project an air of confidence, capability, and strength, despite her blindness. In both, you can sense an underlying sense of anxiety, lest those around them perceive something less than strength and command in their bearing. A second parallel is they both have a feeling of helplessness or vulnerability at their current circumstances. Jamie at his turn of fortune after the robbery from last chapter and venturing into an unknown new world. Jocasta in being forgotten during the pitch explosion. This is Ginger's addition. Not just during the pitch explosion, remember, she also... when Claire found out she was blind, right? When everyone ran toward the skunk or tried to figure out what was going on and Claire looked back and saw that she was like, you know, not freaking out, but lost basically. So it was we're given two examples. Continuing, Jocasta in being forgotten during the pitch explosion, as well as how she is to negotiate the naval contracts after the death of her husband. And Anne S. writes, Ian has also written a separate private letter to Jamie, not to be shown to young Ian. In this passage, Ian shows not only the fear of young Ian's temptation to be a soldier, knowing his spirit of adventure, but also the ongoing devastation of the Highland culture. Finally, to express his real fears for young Ian as well as Jamie, Ian describes what he sees as the effect of war on a man. In this private letter, Ian has managed to tie in so many thoughts and questions. How can he and Jenny entrust young Ian to Jamie and Claire, who have already lost and rescued the boy once? How can they trust that young Ian's future in the colonies is any safer than it would be at home or in the Highland Regiment, considering the wild tales of the American wilderness? Knowing Jamie's history as a soldier and a fugitive, can they trust Jamie to steer young Ian away from a life of war? Can Claire save Jamie's soul from the hardness of war? I think Ian knew that Jamie and Claire would never refuse his request to keep his son, but he wants to impress upon them that his fear for young Ian is not just for his safety, but also for his soul and Jamie's soul. He ties in the forever unfinished business of Leary, yeah, thanks Ian, but ultimately sees hope in Claire's return to Jamie. And Jamie's response after reading the letter? Mm. Chapter 10 gives us the introduction of River Run and many new characters. Jamie is welcomed into an atmosphere that combines elements from both the familiar old world of Scotland and the unfamiliar new world. Jamie has just met his aunt, but is finding that she already has plans for him and is not altogether forthcoming about them. In the end, he gets a big dose of reality from home in Ian's letters. This chapter sets the stage for Jamie and Claire to ultimately decide how they want to live in this new world.
Are we sure Jocasta is not a Fraser?
Oh, dude. I mean, she's got the... Well, I don't know. I don't know that we've seen her stubborn streak yet.
She's definitely a schemer.
That's Mackenzie.
Lord love it. Well, no, like Simon Lovett.
Well, yeah, but Mackenzie's were... The ones who were like the clever, not that others aren't clever, but like sly and manipulative and foxes and schemers. That's what I get when I think Mackenzie. But absolutely. I mean, they do have similar characteristics.
That was chapter 10. Join us next time and we'll be discussing chapter 11 entitled The Law of Bloodshed. And I know it's about... The hairy dude's balls coming back.
Yep.
That's not what it's called. Hang on. It is. It might as well have been called that. Chapter 12 entitled The Return of John Quincy Myers.
Or The Balzac.
The Balzac. Harry Balzac.
Join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. You can find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
And if you want to be a part of our Drums of Autumn read-along, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA to find out all the details.
Now, if you love our show or just like it a lot, and are entertained by it, please visit our Patreon page and consider supporting us. That is patreon.com/outlanderpod. Every little bit helps cover our costs, be it hosting, recording, equipment, etc., and giveaways from time to time. There are also a good number of free ways to help support our show. The most important way you can support us is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family about our show. And thank you, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.